Welcome to Farming for Nature with me, Bridget Barry, where farmers across Ireland who have found a way to work with nature while saving money tell us how they have done it. Kim McCall, a beef farmer in County Kildare, has developed a huge respect for biochar, a soil enhancer that not only he can make inside his own gates, but it comes at zero financial cost to him. Today we hear how Kim makes biochar and how spreading it on his land has made a huge difference to the quality of his soil and everything that grows above it. Kim, thanks for joining us today. I know we're here to talk about biochar, but before you do, you might just set the scene and tell us about your farm.
My farm is quite a large farm. It's about 214 acres of mixture of grassland and forestry. You could call it either forestry or woodland, of which we have about 175 acres of grass, of which we use principally for suckler cows and a few sheep. Suckler cows being Obrax, and we sell them as pedigree Obrax, the heifers to other producers, and the bulls would go to the dairy herd.
Brilliant. And you're a Farming for Nature ambassador, so you have a lot of nature on your farm, and one of the areas that you look at is soil. So biochar, this is one of the angles that you, one of the improvements that you use for your soil. How did you get into biochar?
I first heard about it many years ago. I think it was on Countryfile. They put a little piece on using biochar as a remediation to the ash dieback, where they actually pumped biochar around the ash trees, and they had amazing results. The trees that had it around them actually survived and thrived, whereas everything else in the plantation died. It never really got traction after that, and I sort of forgot about it. And then a few years later, I came across it. People were talking about biochar, and it was sort of always in hushed tones, and you know, it was very secretive. So I said, well, I'd educate myself how to make it. So I found a lady in America called Kelpie Wilson, who is an engineer, and I watched her videos, and she had a couple of kiln designs. So we copied them, and I really just did it as she did, and it works extremely well.
So for someone who doesn't know about it, what is biochar?
Biochar, in a nutshell, is charcoal. And the bio really comes in of its source material, which would be biological, could be wood chip. It could even be oat straw. It could be oat chaff. It could be wheat straw. Or in tropics, it could be rice chaff. So it's biological as opposed to other char, which could be certainly not used agriculturally, coming from other sources, even plastics, say. So we're dealing with a natural biomass and turning it into charcoal.
Great. And how do you make it?
It's called pyrolysis, where you're making biochar in an not necessarily oxygen-free area. You're using it oxygen-starved. So in my case, it's a flame cap kiln. So the flame itself is excluding oxygen reaching the bottom layers of char.
Can you take me through the process on your farm visually? What does it look like? Where are you? What do you bring? How often do you make it?
First of all, you have to have the right feedstock. So in my case, it would be, say, fallen branches from trees in storms or dead trees. So it's really any branch wood that is less than, say, 4 inches across. Anything bigger, we would keep for firewood. So it's hedge trimmings, it's fallen branches, it's all that sort of stuff. But the principal thing is you have to have it dry. So it would be, say, fallen the previous winter, and then we would make biochar in the preceding summer, autumn. You must have a reasonably dry feedstock, otherwise you're going to produce a lot of smoke. And in that this day and age, smoke's not a good idea. And also smoke is unburnt fuel. So the way we make it is we collect all our feedstock. It could be in two or three piles. It could be near the yard, or it could be out in the field. So we collect it all up, make sure it's nice and dry, and have it in sort of a couple of different groupings. So you have very fine stuff in one pile and slightly thicker in another pile. So the first way of producing it is to fill your kiln up. Now, I have an Oregon kiln, which is the one that came from America. We got it made here in a local fabricator. It's made out of 3 mil steel, and it's like a cut-off pyramid upside down. So in principle, it's a container. It's a box. It's four-sided. It'll hold about 3.5 cubic meters of char. And principal thing is to fill it up first to a little bit over level. You could then light it. And the most important thing is you always light the fire on top. Small fire, and it'll actually get bigger and bigger. And as it goes down through the material, it actually gets hotter and it burns the smoke. And smoke, as I said, is unburnt fuel. And when it gets to the bottom, it is very, very hot. You're talking up to 700-800 degrees. And then you never let it go to ash. You start loading again slowly with your slightly finer stuff. And then as it moves up, as it starts to fill, you add the slightly thicker material. And you let it burn, and burn will take about 3.5 hours. The whole time it's actually depositing char at the bottom. And as I said earlier, the flame is actually excluding the oxygen from getting to the bottom. And you know when you're getting it right, because the flame is staying over the kiln and it's lapping in on itself. So it's actually taking the oxygen from the outside and just keeping it on top. And the other most important thing is you have dry wood, and you do it on a very still day. So the heat stays over the kiln, and you don't produce any smoke. Smoke is the one giveaway to making bad char.
Interesting. Presumably you have to stop the process to prevent it going to ash. So how do you stop it?
Exactly. You must not let it get to ash at any stage. When it starts to turn white, you know you're then producing ash. You've taken the feed source all the way through from a growing tree to the carbonization period, then to ash. So you've then, instead of sequestering carbon when you actually use it, you've actually liberated the carbon back to carbon dioxide from whence it came. And that's not what you want to do.
So you're stopping. Do you put water on it? Do you cover the flame? Do you
the way I do it is when either the feedstock has run out or the kiln is full and I can't add any more, I would then quench it with water. And there are a couple of methods that I use. Principally, I either use a hose if I'm doing it in the yard, and I get the water going and I pour it down one side in one corner of the kiln. So I'm actually filling from the bottom, and I let the fire keep going on top till everything is used up. And then I would just gradually sprinkle it on top just to put out anything that's still going, and then keep filling from the bottom. And the reason being is that you do not want to let it go to ash. And you must make sure that it's fully quenched, because I had one or two mistakes where I thought I had quenched it and went away, and I came back and there was a great big hole in it where I'd actually missed a piece and it reignited.
And so good bio char looks like, you know, kind of like charcoal, obviously, like that kind of burnt wood, I suppose.
Yes, it would. This way, if you did it in a different method, say a sealed container, a Tillard or one of the more expensive machines, it would actually, it sort of self-quenches, whereas the flame cap kiln, it doesn't, but it still should come out when you actually, you've taken the water, put the water in, and then you let the water out 24 hours later. And that's the quenching fluid. And I use that back into the slurry tank, or you could reuse it again. You could put it in an IBC, but the biochar then is actually quite hydrophobic. It's actually repelling water, so it doesn't actually take it in easily, because it's still got its natural oils still within the char, even though most of it has been vaporized in the flames. It should have a ring to it when you actually should have a glassy sort of a tinkle to it if you just snap it and drop it on the ground. And it should have a nice shine to it. It shouldn't be dull. It should have a nice shine.
Excellent. And so what's next? So you've got your biochar. What do you do with it next?
What I do with it next would be let it dry, because it will have a certain amount of moisture sort of adhered to the char. Not really much in it, but certainly adhered to it. So you want to let it dry. What I do is I leave it in a heap. I tip it out onto concrete under cover, leave it in a heap. And then when it's reasonably dry, it could be in the summertime, 2 or 3 weeks maximum, could even be a week, is spread it out, rake it out. break it out into an area. 3.5 meters would be an area roughly 25 feet by, say, 10, 12 feet and about an inch and a half thick. And then I roll it with the tractor and roller. Principal reason being is you want to increase the surface area of the chaff down to certainly 1/8 of an inch or less. I mean, pepper dust is wonderful because then you've got a huge surface area. And it's really the surface area of the char that is the most beneficial to the microbes in the soil.
And how do you then spread it on your land, or when do you spread it on your land?
See, that the making of the char, the crushing it, you've now got a material that is very fine, like I say, from 1/8 of an inch down to very, very fine dust. You want to be careful when it's very dry like that. You shouldn't breathe it in. It's not good for you. So a mask is imperative to use, especially when you're crushing it. And then the next thing is you've got your char, which is charcoal. Biochar is like a house with absolutely no people in it, no furniture, nothing. It's an empty house. It's full of microbial pores. It's like a sponge waiting to be rehydrated. So then you either add it to compost, you can add it to farmyard manure, you can add it to slurry, or you can add other inoculants to it, like you could add various teas to it, nettle teas. You can add urine to it. Really, you can add rock dust, that would be basalt. You could add whatever you're having yourself to it. And that then is then added to compost, slurry. It could be watered into your veg garden. You can add seaweed extracts to it. But I principally just put it in the slurry or in the farmyard manure where it is inoculated with various microbes and minerals. It, like I said, it's a house. And not only do they go into it, but they actually adhere to it.
And then how often do you put it, when do you put it on your soil, or, and how often is it, once a year, twice a week?
Yeah, no, good question. If you were, say, in gardening, you could liquefy, you could actually put it into a watering can, add some seaweed to it and various other things to it, and actually just water it around your plants, water it around your veg, your orchard trees. But I, on the farm, we put it into the slurry. So whenever the slurry, and we put it into the slurry from pretty well from day one of the animals coming in. So it gets a continuous addition through the slurry all the way through till when the animals go out. The slurry would then be agitated, say, and spread out on the land. And it is now fully inoculated. The principal reasons for using biochar in the slurry is to lock up nutrients. But they're locked up in the char, but available when needed by the plants via the mycorrhiza and fungi and protozoa and whoever else is in the soil, your microbes.
And in your personal experience, have you seen much difference between biochar and other soil amendments or other NPK replacements? Do you notice a big difference?
For one, it's free. You've made it yourself. All it's taken is time, and it's used up a product that would either have rotted away naturally. Now, there is a trend to leaving these heaps, and they do have their benefits for nature. But if you want to sequester carbon to last in the ground, some people say up to a couple of hundred years, some people say much longer. And it is also as I said before, a home for microbes and a way of storing nutrients. And one of the most important things is actually in water. It actually holds a lot of water and will actually be a benefit to the soil in our changing climate, where the summers are getting warmer and drier and for longer periods. So I'm trying to enhance the water holding capacity in the soil. And it could also work in say very wet soils. It's actually taking up water but increasing the drainage, which is a bit of a strange one to get your head around, but its water holding capacity is very high. I'm not too sure the exact ratios, but somebody said 8-1. So it's an amazing product. And if you can get it for free and you make it yourself, it has to be a benefit. And you're increasing the fungal load in your soil, which is good. We all all the fields need mycorrhiza, and they have been destroyed over time by various applications of fertilizers, sprays. So we need to increase the fungal load in our fields.
And is there any areas on your farm you don't use it?
Yes, in some areas I haven't really got round to using it, especially on some of the dry hills where we don't go with the heavy machinery because it has wetter ground below it, and I just haven't got there. We use it on the principal fields that are used for production, and it certainly works. But the fields where we haven't used it, to be honest, I can't really see a difference, but on the dry hills, they do dry much quicker than on the hills that we do go to with the slurry and so on. So there's a definite difference there, but I'm noticing now in the drier periods, we are holding on to our green fields longer, slightly longer, not forever, but slightly longer than we did before. It's definitely working, but I'm also using other products as well, along with the biochar, which would be biodynamic preparations as well. So I think agriculture on this farm is definitely changing. I mean, my methods have changed drastically in the last 30 years from what I was doing. I mean, set stocking is a definite no-no, whereas rotational grazing is such a good method of working your cattle or sheep around the farm. You give the land time to rest. And yields have gone up, and I haven't reseeded the principal grasses or all the old grasses. And it really came back down to me this year when we cut hay in September. We cut hay in June and September, not a bale in between, because as we know, the summer was pretty dreadful. We got a free reseed when we took all the bales off, and I walked over the field, and a couple of weeks later, that literally billions of seedlings coming up, and they're all coming from the mother plants of the field. They're native to that field for the last donkeys of years, 100, 200 years. So they're getting used to a changing climate. And if I look after them by grazing rotationally and adding nutrients and the biochar and the biodynamic preparations, I don't see why those fields can't produce every bit as much grass at a lower cost than all the reseeded grasslands going on.
Yeah, and I think the interesting thing about biochar, like you say, it's within your own gates. So, you know, there's no kind of financial cost to it. And then it seems relatively easy to make from what I'm hearing. But is there any pitfalls to making or using biochar, do you feel?
The principal pitfall, possibly for gardening, is never put it onto your garden uninoculated, as in with seaweed or nettle juice or whatever you want to use yourself. Because, as I said earlier, it's a sponge. So if you were to put on quite a lot of biochar onto a garden, dig it in, it actually has the ability to suck nutrients out of your garden into the biochar, so inoculating itself. So you would put on biochar, and after 1 year, your garden really has not done very well at all, because it's given to the biochar, it hasn't given to the veg. So it's most important that you actually inoculate it first. So it gives, it's a giving thing rather than letting it as a taker. But where it can be used as a taker is you could actually fill up bags, Hessian bags, say, or even some of these perforated bags like onion bags, with biochar, uncrushed, and put it in your waterways, maybe drainage channels, and it would actually take the nutrients flowing out of drains, say, and it would stop them going into the streams and polluting the streams. And it has been used throughout in some parts of Ireland to do exactly that. You could use a half-ton bag of biochar or like I say, an onion bag. And then that biochar in those bags is now being inoculated with nutrients that you can bring back onto your farm or into your garden and use.
So, Kim, for those who want to consider making biochar, what do you think are the simple steps to consider?
The simple steps to consider are a decent feedstock. So principally dry, and keep it dry. And work out how you want to make it. I mean, there are for a small garden or even a window box, you might just need a tin with a couple of holes in it that you can put some wood in it and put it in your stove. And it's most important to put holes in the tin, otherwise the thing will explode with the gases. And you leave it in there even overnight and you'll have nice char at the end of it. Or you have a thing called a T-Lud, which is a top loading and it's a couple of barrels. You can look up how to make it. Or you can do a burn pile, which is, you might be on slightly shaky ground, but the most important thing is to light it on top. But the best one of all is either a Contiki kiln or a Oregon kiln, or even an old wheelbarrow. It's just a container. So you put your stock in it and you light it on top. It burns down. You add till you've either finished the stock or you are full, and then you quench it. You can quench it with soil as well. It's really just to exclude the oxygen, and you could put a layer of soil over it, keep it tapped down. That takes a little bit longer to go out as such, but your main thing is to keep the oxygen out. You could use a wet blanket. You can use all sorts of things to basically put the flame out. But the most important thing is check that you are putting flame out. Otherwise, it'll just all ignite and burn to ash. It's very easy to make. You will make mistakes. We all make mistakes. But the principle is to use dry material. Otherwise, you will put smoke into the atmosphere. And then you'll draw attention to yourself. And not a good idea in these in these times.
And can you buy it? Or, you know, or is
I think you can buy it. Yeah. You can buy some commercial stuff. I think I don't want to advertise them, but I think there's a crowd in a big company in the west of Ireland now going to produce it commercially. But I still think, you know, for you to make it yourself, there's zero air miles in it. You're using your own produced product, and you get a kick out of doing it. And you know that there's not many people making and sequestering carbon for very little cost. I mean, if it's roughly 3 to 1, so in weight and volume, three parts feedstock to make one part, or a little bit more, say 4 parts feedstock to make one part biochar. And what you're doing is principally is taking 3.5 tons of CO2 out of the air to produce 1 ton of a biochar. So, you know, in theory, you are sequestering 3.5 tons of CO2 into the air. Now, people say, how does that work out? Well, really, you're liberating the oxygen. You're capturing the carbon.
Yeah, amazing. So, Kim, is there any last suggestions or recommendations you'd have around biochar and its use?
I'd get some good books. I have a nice little book. It's a nice starter book. It's called Gardening with Biochar, and it's by Jeff Cox. There are many, many others. Just really educate yourself on how to use it, how to produce it, and don't draw attention to yourself with lots of smoke.
Well, we know if there's smoke, it's actually you're doing the wrong. You're not making biochar.
You're making a mess of it.
Making a mess. Kim, it sounds like you've developed a really serious interest and respect for biochar. So thank you for sharing your knowledge with us today. Sounds like a really interesting addition to the farm. And I like the way that you can tackle it yourself with inside your gates without all you need is a match nearly. And that you're kind of, as you say, sequestering carbon at the same time, as well as potentially adding to the overall biodiversity and fertility of your soil and your farm. Kim McCall, thank you so much for being my guest today.
Thank you.
That's it. You can listen to Farming for Nature on farmingfornature.ie or wherever you get your podcast. Please share, rate and review. It really helps us spread the word. And if you'd like to get in touch, email me on info@farmingfornature.ie.